It's often said that the towns of Ypres and Arras and Albert on the Western Front are haunted by the ghosts of the British Tommy slogging with rifle and plaque through its ruined streets to its destiny up the line. But what about the places of Boulogne and Etaples and Rouen? Because the ghosts there would be called Elsie or Gladys or Dorothy, and her ankles would be swollen, her feet are aching, her hands reddened and rough. She's got little money, no vote, and has almost forgotten what it feels like to be really warm. She sleeps in a tent. Unless she's told a lie about her age, she's 23. She's the daughter of a clergyman, a lawyer, or a prosperous businessman, and has been privately educated and groomed to be a lady. She wears the outdoor uniform of a VAD or an army nurse, and she's on active service and as much a part of the war as Tommy Atkins. These are the first few words that were written by the famous author Lynn MacDonald in her book that she called The Roses of No Man's Land. And she went on to say that on the face of it, no one could have been less equipped for the job than those gently nurtured girls who walked straight out of Edwardian drawing rooms into the manifold horrors of the First World War. These girls had to be tough. They worked in flooded operating theatres in Flanders, where in the Big Push there might be four operations going on at any one time, and as many as 10 amputations an hour. They nursed men with terrible wounds and saw them off to convalescent camps, or laid them out when they died. They nursed in wards where the stench of gangrenous wounds was almost overpowering. They nursed men choking to death as the fluid rose in their gas lungs, men whose faces were mutilated beyond recognition, whose bodies were mangled beyond repair, whose nerves were shattered beyond redemption. So welcome to another episode of the podcast that me, Terry Wenham, I've called Tales from the Battlefields. And this week I wanted to look at a different aspect of the battlefield, and that's what went on in the casualty clearing stations and the field ambulance units and the base hospitals and even at the hospitals in the United Kingdom after Tommy Atkins, the British Tommy, had been evacuated from the trenches and fed his way through the process of evacuation. So we're going to look at some of the eyewitness accounts that Lynn MacDonald contained in her book The Roses of No Man's Land, which was published in 1980. And over 40 years later, it's a valuable source for trying to understand what those nurses, those young girls from Edwardian Britain, went through when they encountered the shock of dealing with these young boys that had been evacuated from the battlefields. I said at the beginning when I started recording these podcasts last year that I wanted to give a voice to those soldiers that previously didn't have a voice, perhaps they'd never been published before. Now, of course, the stories that we're going to look at today, a lot of them are published accounts, but they've probably not been spoken about in podcasts before. They're not famous. None of these people are famous, but they've all got incredible stories to tell, and that's what I wanted to do this week. So before we go any further, I thought it would be useful to explain how the medical evacuation of the wounded worked on the Western Front. This process started really at the beginning of the war, and it remained in place throughout the 4 years. Now, if a soldier had been wounded on an attack, or had been wounded perhaps by a shell whilst in the trenches, he would be picked up by the infantry stretcher bearers, and they would attempt to carry the casualty back to a regimental aid post. Now, the regimental aid post was effectively in the front line, in one of the support or reserve trenches. And here there would be a doctor, and the soldier's injuries would be triaged. He would attempt to dress the soldier's wounds, and he would give him some kind of pain relief. The Royal Army Medical Corps stretcher bearers would then take the soldier to a dressing station. Now, it was the field ambulance that ran the advance and the main dressing stations. The field ambulance was a unit. It wasn't actually a vehicle. And here the soldier would receive further treatment, and then he'd be moved on by road transport or light railway, and he'd eventually arrive at a casualty clearing station. Now, the casualty clearing station was the first place where major surgery could be carried out, and amputations especially would take place. And the most obvious example of a casualty clearing station was Remy Siding, which we're going to talk about in this podcast. And this is the location of the massive Lischenhoek cemetery close to Poperinge, about 5 or 6 miles west of Ypres, which is now the scene of 10,000 burials. And these are the men and one woman that died in the several casualty clearing stations that were at Remy Siding between 1915 and 1919. So here, as we said, the soldier would get major surgery carried out, and these would often be located next to railway lines, and that would help speed up the process of evacuation. Now, hopefully, the soldier would survive the surgery, and he would then be evacuated using that train system to the base hospitals. And these were usually based on the coast, the French coast, at places like Le Havre and Boulogne. There was a number of base hospitals in the Boulogne area. And from there, the soldier, having been stabilised even further and perhaps had more surgery carried out, if he still survived, he would be transferred back to the UK, to general hospitals in the UK. And my own great-uncle Henry, who I talked about in the first podcast, he went through this process when he was wounded during the Second Battle of Ypres, and he ended up at a general hospital at Southmead in Bristol. And he returned to the trenches, and during the Battle of the Somme, he once again went through the evacuation process, having been wounded at Poitiers in August of 1916. But he only reached as far as a field ambulance, an advanced or a dressing station, about 5 miles away from where he was wounded. And there he died of his wounds the following day. So let's start by looking at an example of who these Edwardian girls were. There was one girl called Kit Dodsworth, and she was the daughter of a lawyer in Yorkshire, and she was typical of her generation. And this is what Kit said, and she's quoted in that book by Lynn MacDonald, The Roses of No Man's Land. She said, "We were terribly strictly brought up. Until I was 18, I lived up in the schoolroom. If the grown-ups had a tennis party, we were allowed to come down and field the balls for them, but we had to go back to the schoolroom for tea and then go down again. We never met anyone, and I was petrified with shyness. I came out at a big dance. It was the Yorkshire Hussars Ball, and I had a marvellous dress. It was white satin, all beaded. It cost £12, and that was a frightful price. After that one evening, you were grown up. Until then, you were a child. We lived very comfortably with lots of servants, so there was no real work to do. We tidied our rooms. We paid calls. We had tea parties. We sewed. We taught at Sunday school. We organised bazaars and fetes. We made sweets and cakes for them. We always seemed to be busy." So as I'm reading that, I'm thinking, what a tremendous shock that must have been to Kit and the other girls of her age. Obviously, when war was declared, they saw their brothers and maybe their dads go off to the Western Front. And they probably went off their relatives as officers, commissioned straight in. And they would have seen the young men in their house, maybe the servants, go off and join the infantry in the other ranks. So it was perhaps understandable that they wanted to contribute something as well. But then they've gone from that sheltered upbringing. You know, they were still only in their early 20s. They were supposed to be 23. And they've gone from organising tea parties and making cakes to help him with amputations and dealing with the gas cases at places like Etaples. It really must have been a terrible, terrible shock for those young girls. So let's look at each of those medical centres that were used during the evacuation of the wounded. And the first one that we mentioned there was an aid post where the regimental medical officer had established a place where the soldiers could be given basic help. And there's a private Walter Williamson, and he wrote an account of what it was like to work at one of these aid posts close to the front line during the Third Battle of Ypres that we call Passchendaele in August of 1917. And he said, and I quote, "The place had simply been battered with shell fire and the road ploughed up. This had now settled down to one horrible level surface of water and oozing mud. Stretchers with their pitiful burdens were brought out from the inner recesses of the ruins, and we were detailed each four to a stretcher, containing a badly wounded lad who was only conscious enough to feebly moan to us to put him straight on the boat to Blighty. we heaved the stretcher on our shoulders and started off that long-remembered journey down the St. Julian Road. In addition to being weak and tired, our uneven heights made carrying difficult, and it must have been torture for the poor occupants of the stretcher. In the best places, the road was nearly knee-deep in mud, and the shell holes could not be located except by testing each foothold. Planks had been put down in places where the whole width of the road had been blown up, but these were now floating aimlessly about, and any attempt to use them would have resulted in a spill and hurling our burden into the mud. Rain still poured down unceasingly, and the road was being shelled viciously. We could not well duck at the shells with a badly wounded man dependent on steady shoulders, and all we could do was plod through and trust to good luck. He also goes on to say that that road near St. Julian was a gruesome nightmare. Bodies lay in the mud all along the road, and burial parties were busy collecting them as best they could. Dead mules, horses, wreck guns, limbers, and all the terrible debris of battle lay in the mud. We were getting on now that we could not carry the stretcher more than 100 yards at a stretch, and each time we rested, we found it more difficult to heave it up again, and we plodded along with red-hot shoulders and cracking backs, sometimes having to get nearly waist-deep to find a foothold across some huge hole that stretched from one side of the road to the other. Now, they did eventually get this poor man to a motor ambulance, and then he'd have been taken to a dressing station or a casualty clearing station like the one at Remy Sidings, which is now seen, as I said earlier, of Lishenhook Cemetery. Now, it could be that that young lad was transferred to Remy Sidings because we've got a report from a US surgeon called George Croyle, and he was working at Remy Sidings on the same night, and he said the stream of wounded men began to increase in volume, slowly at first, then rapidly, until the entire Remy Siding was swamped. By the night of August the 1st, every bed, every aisle, every tent, every inch of floor space was occupied by stretchers. Then the rows of stretchers spread out over the lawn around the huts, flown out towards the railway. The operating rooms ran day and night without ceasing. Teams worked steadily for 12 hours on, 12 hours off. They passed through the Remy Siding group of three casualty clearing stations. Over 10,000 wounded in the first 48 hours. I had 200 deaths in one night in my service. The seriously wounded piled up so fast that nothing could be done with them, and I told the sister to administer as near an overdose of morphine as was possible to keep them free of suffering. And of course, those young girls that we talked about, that we're going to talk about in this podcast, they're working in the casualty clearing station. This is about the closest that they would get to the front line. No closer, because of course they would be in danger. And in fact, an example of how dangerous it was even in the casualty clearing stations is the fact that at Lishenhook Cemetery, we've got Nellie Spindler buried. She's probably the most famous grave that people always go to see. She's the only woman in amongst the nearly 11,000 burials in Lishenhook. And she was killed, died of her wounds shortly after being hit during an air raid at the Brandhoke Casualty Clearing Station, which is a few miles away from Lishenhook. She wasn't buried at Brandhoke, she was brought to Lishenhook. So now let's look at an example of what happened at one of the base or general hospitals near Boulogne. There was a sister, Christina Hastings, and the account that I'm going to read you now is extremely graphic. So I would suggest that if you can't stomach this, you'd wind on a couple of minutes and miss this one out. It's only fair, I think, to read these accounts to try and get us to understand what it must have been like, not just for the wounded, not just for the soldier, but these young girls that perhaps had never seen or touched a man's body before, because this is what Christina Hastings had to deal with. There was a young lad who was badly wounded. He had all his genital parts blown off. Bad as he was always cheerful about it. I used to wonder how he stood it. It was a terrible dressing to do and very, very hard on him. We used to see him watching us as the dressing trolley came down the ward, and you could see that he was dreading the moment when we would get to him. The wound, it was just a hole, was packed with gauze with the silver tube coming out of it. There was a catheter that led into his bladder. Every morning all the packing had to be pulled out bit by bit, the hole cleaned and the gauze packed back in it again, and it was agony. We all used to dread it because it was so very hard on him. He used to cry. He couldn't help it, but he felt very badly about crying. and we used to cover his face with a handkerchief so he wouldn't be embarrassed about it. He was no good for about an hour after the dressing was done. He just lay there, and we would give him a drop of brandy or a glass of champagne. He was about 25. He recovered. Eventually, we were able to send him back to England, and I expect he was discharged from the army. But he'd never be any good as a man after that. I wonder who that young boy was, what became of him. And I wonder how those nurses, perhaps dealing with a casualty like that for the first time, I wonder how they slept that night, how they got on with their job. I'm pretty sure how they got on with it. They just did. That's the way that generation were, wasn't it? Now, I mentioned that nurses were only allowed to serve in casualty clearing stations or base hospitals, no closer to the front. But with every rule, there's always an exception. And there are two well-known exceptions, two nurses called Elsie Knocker and Marie Gooden Chisholm, I think it's pronounced. As far as we know, they were the only women to nurse actually on the front line during the Great War. Now, these ladies had become friends after meeting at a motorcycle club in 1912. And when war broke out, they went off to London on their motorbike, in their words, to do their bit. And within a month, somehow they managed to find their way on the front line near Ypres. And they were evacuating wounded soldiers from a first aid post just 100 yards from the trenches. And there are photographs of them driving a motorised ambulance, moving the casualties to hospital in these ambulances. Now, while they were doing this, of course, they were under constant threat from shell fire and sniper fire. And their reputation spread. It soon got heard about them back home in Britain. They got visited by journalists, photographers. And even King Albert of Belgium visited them to pay his respects to them. They were awarded 17 medals for bravery and self-sacrifice. And there's a lady called Diane Atkinson. She's written a book about them called Elsie and Marie Go to War. And I'm sure you'll be able to find that book through all the usual sources like Amazon. So let's now look at an incredible love story that came out of the trenches. Usually all we talk about is tragedy, sadness, pain and sorrow. But occasionally a happy story comes up. And there was an officer called Hugh Shepherd, and he was serving with the 6th Battalion of the Manchester Regiment. And he was gassed and wounded near Ypres in 1917. It could easily have been another of those sad stories. Now, as we know, in September of 1917, the Third Battle of Ypres, we call Passchendaele, was in full swing, and the conditions for the combatants were getting worse and worse as the rain continued to fall on the smashed landscape of Flanders. Now, Hugh Shepherd's battalion, the 6th Manchester's, they'd been ordered to attack several ruined farm buildings on the Fresenberg Ridge. And these farm buildings, farm complexes really, they'd been turned into strong German positions. They'd been reinforced with concrete. Now, during this action, during this attack, Hugh suffered with the effects of gas poisoning, and he was evacuated to a casualty clearing station well behind the lines. And from there, he moved to one of these large base hospitals before being transferred back to the UK. Now, at some point along the way, we don't know exactly where, he met a nurse called Annie. No doubt many young, wounded soldiers became very fond of their nurses. But in this case, the feelings were reciprocated, and Annie and Hugh fell in love. They married, had children, and years later, their grandson, Martin Shepherd, was born. So without the horrors of those battlefields, Hugh and Annie would never have met up. And Martin would never have been born. Many years later, the story of his grandparents inspired Martin to do some fundraising for the ABF Soldiers Charity. And he's since carried out the frontline walk that we talked about so often on this podcast, and on at least three, might even be four occasions. I remember him doing the frontline walk in 2016. And in the book that Steve Roberts and I wrote about the frontline walk, Martin is quoted. And he said, the walk is always an emotional event, even if you do not have family who served. But in both Flanders and the Somme, I walked in my late grandfather's footsteps. So it was even more emotional for me. Now, when I was a young boy growing up in the 1970s, I was mad keen on football. And I remember my mum and dad buying me football boots. And of course, going out into the muddy fields and playing, or trying to play football, I was absolutely hopeless, but trying to play football with these boots they bought me. But these boots weren't waterproof. They were no use at all, really, even if I was any good. And they'd let the wet in. And I didn't come home, of course, as every 7 or 8 year old boy would tell you, they'd still be out there playing football in the wet, and my feet would go numb, and I'd go home and my mum would put them up against the radiator or put me in a hot bath, and after a while I would soon get the feeling back in my feet. But now I look back on that and I think, what must it have been like, especially in the years of 1916, 1917, that cold winter on the Somme when the temperatures went down to something like minus 20, minus 25 degrees. Because when that snow and ice melted, the trenches became flooded with this icy cold water, and the soldiers, whilst they were in those trenches, had nowhere to go. And that's when that famous, that dreadfully infamous condition really, called trench foot, came in. It was made worse, of course, because the soldiers were wearing those tightly bound putties that become soaking wet. And really, it can be best described as a vast and excruciatingly painful chilblain. I suppose chilblains is what I got when I was trying to play football. And in some cases, the men were literally unable to walk. Now, a good example of this was the 16th Battalion of the Highland Light Infantry, the Scotsmen. They were serving at Serre in that winter of 1916-17. And one account, again taken from Lynn MacDonald's book, The Roses of No Man's Land, said, "Men stood up in knee-deep posts. They could not lie down to sleep or even in places sit down. When fatigue became unbearable, two men, in at least one known case, stood and slept back to back, and a third kept watch to prevent a collapse in the mud. The approach to the front line by Nairn Dump was over a light railway track in which progress was made by leaping from sleeper to sleeper. To miss a sleeper was to be bogged down to the waist or filthily submerged." Now, that particular battalion suffered dreadfully with trench foot during that winter. And when they were evacuated from the trenches, they reached the 26th General Hospital at Cammiers near Boulogne. And there was a Margaret Ellis. She was serving there. And this is what she reported from those boys. She said they were dreadful, these Glasgow boys. They were shockers. Worse than any, because they were always up to something. One of those little HLI boys came in with bad feet. They were really bad because he'd lost several toes, which had to be amputated. But as soon as we allowed him to get up for a time, he was always round the ward, tormenting everybody who was still in bed. Another nurse, Kathleen Yarwood, she was working at a military hospital in Rochdale in Lancashire, and she said some of the trench feet and frostbite cases were so bad they had to be sent home. We had a tremendous number of frostbite cases at the beginning of 1917. In fact, we had a whole ward of them, and another nurse and myself were in charge of that for quite a long time. We had to rub their feet every morning and every evening with warm olive oil for about a quarter of an hour or so, massage it well in and wrap their feet in cotton wool and oiled silk. All sorts of things just to keep them warm. Their feet were absolutely white, swollen up and dead. Some of their toes dropped off with it and their feet looked dreadful. We would say, "I'll stick a pin in you, can you feel it?" Whenever they did feel the pen prick, we knew that life was coming back. Then we'd see a little bit of pink coming up and everybody in the ward would cheer. It was very painful for them when the feeling started to come back, and some of them had to have crutches. They couldn't walk at all because they simply couldn't feel their feet. And as I'm reading that, again, I'm thinking about the whole wide variety of problems that these nurses had to deal with. I wonder whether they'd been trained to deal with trench foot. Probably not. They must have been trained with how to change dressings and bandages. But again, they probably didn't know that they were going to encounter soldiers with trench feet, not until they were faced with it. It must have been another shock. Who on earth would imagine taking a soldier's sock or putty off and finding their toes or maybe even their foot dropping off? Just absolutely unbelievable when you think about it now. So let's now look at another condition, which again, no one had prepared for, and that was shell shock. This was the first time that an industrial war had been fought anywhere in the world. And it goes without saying that some soldiers, not all, there's a myth that everybody suffered from shell shock. No, they didn't. Who knows when a soldier was going to go down with shell shock? You couldn't tell. Men that you thought would be able to put up with it suddenly cracked under the pressure. Others that appeared weak somehow managed to put up with the constant shelling, and not knowing whether they would come out of the trenches, mutilated, or even killed. and it wasn't always a major attack or a major episode of shelling that caused the manager to crack up. A man could be sent down the line in a shock condition at any time. It could be as a result of a trivial incident which finally made him snap and drain him of any strength that he had left after months and years at the front line. Now, there was a sister, Mary Stollard, and she was working at a military hospital in Leeds. And this is what she said about shell shock. She said, in the early days when the men first came in, they were young and enthusiastic. I'd like to have a pop at the Boche. I'll teach them this, that and the other. I'd like to go across and give them a good old stabbing. These were the things they used to say, but little by little, that attitude changed. They didn't want to go back, and they would do almost anything to stay in England. We had one man who cried and cried, and our MO, Colonel Vinin, was very sympathetic with him. He'd been out in France for 18 months, and the Colonel said, I'm going to discharge him, sister, he's done his bit. They were very pathetic, these shell-shock boys, and a lot of them were very sensitive about the fact that they were incontinent. They'd say, I'm terribly sorry about it, sister. It's shaken me all over and I can't control it. Just imagine to wet the bed at my age. And I'd say to them, we'll see to that. Don't worry about it. I used to give them a bedpan in the locker beside them and keep it as quiet as possible. Those poor fellows, they were so embarrassed, especially the better class men. Claire Elsie Tisdall, she was working in an ambulance column in London. And she said, I got quite used to carrying shell shock patients in the ambulance. It was a horrible thing because sometimes you used to get these attacks, rather like epileptic fits in a way. They became quite unconscious with violent shivering and shaking, and you had to keep them from banging themselves about too much until they came round again. The great thing was to keep them from falling off the stretchers. And for that reason, we used to take just one at a time in the ambulance because you'd never be able to cope with four cases at once as you could with the ordinary wounded. Of course, we had the so-called milder cases. We didn't carry the dangerous ones. They always tried to keep that away from us, and they came in a separate part of the train. But it happened one evening when there was just one too many of us nurses. So I didn't go with an ambulance, and I was left on the platform. I noticed that some of our men from the column were still there. And then I noticed another sort of ambulance come into the station, not one of ours. It was completely closed up. I said to one of the men, what's this ambulance coming in? Haven't we done the train? He said, no, sister, this is from the asylum. It's for the hopeless mental cases. I didn't look. They'd gone right off their heads. I didn't want to see them. There was nothing you could do, and they were going to a special place. They were terrible. And I was reading that once again. My memories went back to the early 1970s and living in South East London. And I remember my mum and dad telling me that in the area there were a number of what we called mental hospitals or asylums. And I suppose being in the late 60s and early 70s, some of those men that had suffered from terrible, those bad cases that she talked about of shell shock were being housed in those asylums, those mental hospitals at places like Bexley, and perhaps they spent the rest of their lives there. We didn't know. They weren't talked about it. Those poor lads, they were no doubt shut away for the rest of their lives. Did they ever recover from what they saw? And then I think about my own grandfather, Arthur Wenham, who'd won the Distinguished Conduct Medal at Albers Ridge in 1915. And I know that he spent some of his time during the war years, up in Scotland. But we don't know why. He never mentioned this. We just know from a newspaper article, this is where he was physically awarded his Distinguished Conduct Medal about 18 months after he'd earned it during the Battle of Albers Ridge. And maybe he was up there recovering from shell shock, because the memories I have of my granddad are not that pleasant, to be honest. He was always grumpy. He was always almost aggressive, I suppose. And talking to my dad when he was alive and other relatives, that's how he was. And Grandad had served in the Royal Garrison Artillery all 4 years on the war. We know, obviously, if he was up in Scotland, there's no reason for him to be in Scotland. Maybe he was there being treated for shell shock. And maybe that explains why, for the rest of his life, he was never the same man as he was before the war. That's just a thought. I've got no evidence to back that up. It's just, again, doing this podcast, it just, I'm sure it does with everybody, it takes you back, people of our age in their 50s, it takes you back to memories connected with the war going back to your childhood. So in the second half of this podcast, I want to talk about some of the nurses that are buried in one of the biggest cemeteries. In fact, the largest Commonwealth War Graves Commission cemetery in France at Etaples, or Etaples, as the soldiers called it. There are almost 11,000 Commonwealth burials in this cemetery, the earliest dating from May of 1915. Now, during the First World War, the area around Etaples was the scene of massive concentrations of reinforcement camps and hospitals. It was far enough away from the front to be remote from any attack, apart from, as we're going to find out, from aircraft, and it was also accessible by railway from both the northern or the southern battlefields. And in 1917, there was 100,000 troops that were camped along the sand dunes. It's not far from Boulogne. And the hospitals, which included 11 general hospitals, one stationary, four Red Cross hospitals and a convalescent depot, could deal with 22,000 wounded or sick. And in fact, in September 1919, 10 months after the armistice, there were still three hospitals and the convalescent depot that remained there. In the Second World War, there were once again, briefly, hospitals that were stationed at Etaples. And there are 119 Second World War burials within the cemetery. The cemetery itself was designed by Sir Edward Lutyens and also George Hartley Goldsmith. And there are a total burials there, including French and other nationals and a civilian that we're going to find out in a minute, of 11,553. So the first story that I wanted to talk about from Etaples is actually a husband and wife, and the wife was a civilian. Private Albert Grover of the 6th Battalion, the Queen's, the Royal West Surrey Regiment. And he died a month after the war had ended on the 17th of December 1918, aged just 23, and he died of his wounds. Now, his wife was called Florence, and Albert and Florence had married at St Nicholas Parish Church in Guildford on the 10th of February 1918. Now, at some point in late 1918, close to the armistice, Albert had been wounded in action, and he was conveyed to Etaples through the process of evacuation that we talked about, and he was admitted to the number 26 General Hospital. Now, they knew, unfortunately, that his wounds were so bad that it was highly unlikely that he was going to survive. And his wounds were so bad that they couldn't evacuate him back to the UK. So this late in the war, the unusual step of allowing his civilian wife to visit him at Etaples was allowed. So Florence travelled to France to be with her husband that she'd married just a few months earlier. And she did meet him, she did meet up with him, but of course what was happening at this stage in the war was the flu pandemic. And she was taken ill with flu, and tragically she passed away on the 26th of November 1918. And she was laid to rest in that cemetery at Etaples. But just 21 days later, Albert also died. He'd also contracted influenza, and together with his wounds, it meant he had no chance. And they are buried together. Albert's family wrote this tribute about him. They said, "Day by day, we all do miss him. Words would fail our loss to tell, but in heaven we hope to meet him, evermore with him to dwell." And about Florence, who they called Flossie, say she was just 21, and the family wrote, "We loved her, oh, no tongue can tell, how much we loved her, and how well God loved her too, and thought it best to take her home with him to rest." One of the nurses working at Etaples was 32-year-old Mary Lynette Crutzen, and she became a voluntary aid detachment nurse, a VAD, and she trained in local hospitals in Nottingham and passed her exams. Now, she remained in Nottingham until 1915, when she and her best friend Christy received instructions to leave for the hospital at Le Trepeau on the coast in France. She spent the next 4 years at the hospitals at Le Trepeau, at Wimereux, and finally at Etaples. She kept a diary of her wartime experiences, which were published in 2013. And This extract details the first time that she saw Etapla. She said, "We're travelling now with a whole party of Canadian nurses who came over with us yesterday. We don't take it to them greatly, but converse with the ones in our compartment during the journey. They're on their way to Rouen, but we got out before. As a group, they are active, waving to all soldiers who pass on the way. We saw large hut hospitals in Etapla and thought this must be where the vads were being sent yesterday. It looked very nice and fresh white tents planted in neat rows. The whole life over here is intensely interesting, but a serious atmosphere prevails. Much more the real business of war." Now, unfortunately, Dorothea was wounded during an air raid, which we're going to talk about in a minute. And in March 1919, she became ill. And she's another one of those nurses that's buried in the place that she served with such distinction. So for the last section of this podcast, it's about just one day that I wanted to talk about and the dreadful things that happened on what was Whit Sunday, the 19th of May, 1918. It had been a clear, bright day. There was a cloudless sky at night. And in the evening, some sisters at one of the hospitals had been to a concert and they were returning to their quarters when they heard two shots from the north, followed by a loud humming. Most of the personnel and most of the patients were asleep at the time. And one of the sisters thought that it was a Gotha, a German bomber. Nothing could be seen, but almost instantly there came a terrific crash and a monster bomb fell directly on the quarters of the orderlies and the other male hospital attendants. And it did turn out to be one of those dreadful nights where so many wounded soldiers were killed and also so many of the nurses, many of them Canadians, that were there. And to tell the story of what happened that night, I'm going to quote from a book that was written by a man that was there, at F.A. Mackenzie, and it's a section of a book that he wrote that he called Through the Hindenburg Line. Now, as a bit of background to this, the British authorities didn't think that the Germans would bomb such a large hospital centre. So there were no dugouts, no bomb-proof casemates and no protection against any shell splinters. The sides of the huts were not even sandbagged, and so they didn't present any protection of any kind. The British Army authorities probably felt that the very openness of the place was its best protection, because Etapla was an enormous place, and still is, although much of it has now been built over and is a housing estate. So going back to Mackenzie's book, he tells us nothing could be seen, but almost instantly came a terrific crash. The orderlies that were there were all elderly men beyond fighting age. Most of them were asleep. The bomb made a direct hit on a wooden building, wiping it out, and started a considerable fire. Some of the orderlies were so blown to bits that it was afterwards found impossible to recognise their remains. The fire caught a big tent nearby, lighting the whole neighbourhood. There was a squadron of aeroplanes overhead, a line of them, each some distance apart from each other. They dropped their bombs in lines, crashing and smashing the hospitals. The bombs continued to fall for some time. Then there came a pause. The first squadron had exhausted its supplies. Three other squadrons came up at intervals. Hour after hour that night, the hellish bombardment from the sky was maintained. What was happening down below? At the first explosion, the officer in charge of one hospital, Lieutenant Colonel J.A. Gunn, moved out to take command of the situation. He instantly had the lights turned out. He went from point to point, amid the bursting bombs, directing affairs. He continued to the sisters' quarters and commanded that they should all lie down under their beds. Then he hurried across the open to where a tent was burning to help some men put it out. As he started to fight the flames, another bomb fell, and an orderly, 50 years old, was killed at his side. In the wards, patients and nurses took the situation with remarkable calm. The chief anxiety of the patients was lest the sisters should be hurt. The sisters on their part moved about doing whatever they could. All that they could do was as nothing, because there was nothing possible in this, the way of protection. "Lie down, sister, lie down," the men called at each crash. In one ward where the sister refused to protect herself, some of the wounded soldiers caught her and held her down. "We won't let you get killed," they said, and they tried to shelter her with their own bodies. Now, the report goes on to say that there were 1,156 patients in the hospital that night. 300 of these were femur cases where their legs had been broken. And the patients had to lie with the legs fixed by bandages in an extended position to a firm, immovable framework. And this, of course, meant that they couldn't move. They couldn't stir. They'd simply to lie there helpless with the bombs were bursting around them. The only thing that could be done for most of the others was to place them under their beds. In one of the nurses' quarters, the day sisters off duty hurried to the doorway when the first crash came. The call came over for two sisters to go and help at a critical point. "Who will go?" called the matron. Every nurse volunteered. She picked on the nearest two girls, who moved out amidst the bursting shell fragments as quietly and as bravely as any soldiers going on a forlorn hope. Then she told the others to get back to their rooms and lie under the beds. When the first German squadron sailed away, lights were turned on in the operating theatres. Doctors, nurses and the remaining orderlies started to try to do something for the badly wounded. Doctors and nurses began sifting out the living from the dead. They had barely set to work again before the bombs began to fall again. At one point, a German plane came low and swept the rescue parties with a machine gun. The most awful scene of all was around the burning tents and huts. You can imagine what it was like getting the killed and wounded out of those burning huts, wrote one man. Some of them had arms and legs blown away. Some were headless. It was terrible. No words can convey any full impression of the horror at that time. The report goes on to say that the raid lasted 2 hours and the casualties were very considerable. The first bombs that fell on the sleeping quarters of the men attendants killed or wounded more than half of them. 51 NCOs and men were killed and 45 wounded, six of them so seriously that they died afterwards. Six patients were killed and 32 wounded, of whom two died afterwards. A few days later, two German airmen were captured. They were taken to the hospitals and they were nursed. And they gave the reason that they did not know that they were hospitals below. But of course, the British didn't believe them. The lights of the burning building alone must have revealed that they were bombing the hospitals. The German authorities knew the position of the hospitals, and it was a brilliant moonlit night, and the men flew very low. We've got another report of what happened that night that comes from a letter written by a Sergeant Major A.P. Reed. And he says, "Nearly all the WOs, NCOs and the men were in bed, except a few of the sergeants and night nursing staff. The poor chaps didn't have the smallest chance of escape. Many of them were burned to death in their beds, while others had their legs blown off and were dependent upon the other boys carrying them out. And let me say that the boys who did not get hit in the first few strafes did wonderful work extinguishing the fires and carrying out the wounded. They were absolutely wonderful. With Fritz still buzzing directly overhead and bombs still dropping, with a barrage of our own and French anti-aircraft guns that was simply hellish and shrapnel digging up the ground all around you, they brought out every one of our wounded who was still alive. And before the all-clear had sounded, everybody that could be discovered, dead or alive, had been taken away from the debris of the quarters. Not only had they taken them out, but those who were still alive on reaching the operating room were rushed in there, and while the bombs were dropping, the operating room was going full swing and our casualties were being attended. Our officers' quarters and sisters' quarters, which were on the right of ours, were also badly hit, one officer and one sister having been killed outright, and another officer and two sisters having died of wounds, while about eight officers and 10 sisters were invalided to England with their wounds. Among other ranks, about 60 were killed and 80 wounded. These casualties represented about 60% of our entire personnel. The raid lasted about 3 hours, during which time the enemy, not content with using bombs on us, turned on his machine guns. We hadn't a single trench in which to take cover, absolutely nothing. One could only flatten out where he chanced to be and take a chance on not being hit. Next morning, about 60 NCOs and men out of 200 paraded to answer to their names. Needless to say, I had to clear my throat many times during the calling of the roll, when name after name would be called out and only an unearthly silence in which you could hear a pin drop, was the answer. We lost some fine chaps. I'd got to know them and to appreciate what fine fellows they all were. They'd been with the unit, most of them, from the very start of the war, and only 2 days before, we'd celebrated the third anniversary of their arrival in France by a regimental dinner. We buried them all about 7 o'clock on the night of May 22nd, and I shall never forget that night. They were all buried in trenches in the military cemetery at Etaples, and each grave is marked with a cross with full particulars. Before leaving Etaples, the entire unit paraded to the graves to bid farewell to our comrades and to decorate the graves of those we must leave behind. It was the most impressive ceremony and concluded with the reveille instead of the last post. I cannot describe what happened to the other units that night, but I do know the casualties were about 300 to 400. By examining the Commonwealth War Graves Commission records, I found that there were 120 men and women that were killed outright on that day, the 19th of May 1918. 47 of them were from Canada, most of them serving in the Canadian Army Medical Corps at the 1st Canadian General Hospital, which is where those reports came from. And that was, of course, just the men and women that died on the day. Many more would have died of their wounds in the following days. And all of those 120 that died that day are buried where they died, at Etaples. So let's now look at some of the individual nurses, mainly serving with the Canadian Army Nursing Service, that died as a result of that air raid on Etaples. And the first one I wanted to look at was a lady called Nursing Sister Margaret Lowe, and she was 32 years old. She was born in 1888 in Scotland, and she moved to Canada before 1917, where she trained as a nurse at the Winnipeg Civil Hospital. She enlisted in the Canadian Army Nursing Service in May 1917, and she sailed from Halifax on the 29th of May 1917 and arrived in Liverpool on the 8th of June 1917. She was initially posted to a Canadian hospital in Orpington in Kent. The hospital was staffed by Canadian nurses and personnel from the Canadian Army Medical Corps, and it was one of the first hospitals to establish therapy for patients that were suffering from shell shock. By January 1919, more than 25,000 wounded troops had been treated at this hospital in Orpington, and less than 1% of those had actually died. Now, on the 5th of October 1917, Margaret was posted to the 10th Canadian General Hospital, and she was transferred to the 1st Canadian Hospital on the 29th of November 1917. Now, she arrived in France on the 26th of January 1918, and was posted to the 10th Canadian Stationary Hospital. And on that day, the 19th of May 1918, she was one of 66 Canadians that were killed, 73 wounded, and she was one of those that was wounded. She was struck by several bomb fragments, and she suffered a fractured skull, and some of the shrapnel actually penetrated her chest. She was admitted to the 24th General Hospital at Etaples, but she died of her wounds 10 days later, and she was laid to rest in the cemetery a few days later. There's a few photos that I've found here that someone's given me, and it shows the actual funeral of Sister Margaret Lowe. And she's being carried by a number of British soldiers, and the procession is being headed by a sergeant. And the procession is being watched by other soldiers, all with their heads bowed, of course, and we can see nurses and other staff also watching the procession. And then, after she's been buried, we can see nursing sisters placing flowers on her grave, and she's surrounded by hundreds, if not thousands, of other wooden crosses. This, of course, being in the days before the wooden crosses were replaced with the Portland headstones that we see today. Then there was Catherine Maud MacDonald, and she was born in Ontario in January 1883. And she took her nursing training at Victoria Hospital in Ontario, and she graduated in May 1915. She sent to England in 1917, and she was one of those that was killed in that air raid. And back at home, there was an article which described Catherine. And it said, killed in action, nurse gives her life. As recorded in the Courier on Thursday, nursing sister Catherine Maud MacDonald was killed on May the 19th, Sunday last. Word to this effect has been received by her mother, Mrs. M.M. MacDonald of 165 Market Street. Miss MacDonald is the first Brantford nurse to make the supreme sacrifice. Born and educated here, Miss MacDonald was a graduate nurse of Victoria Hospital and early in the war became attached to the military barracks hospital staff there. She went overseas at Easter of 1917 and crossed to the front in January of this year, becoming attached to No. 1 Canadian General Hospital. It is believed that she met her death in a German air attack on the hospital. Miss MacDonald was a member of the Grace Church and leaves her mother and one sister, Miss Florence MacDonald, in addition to a host of friends who will long cherish the memory of one who gave her life in a labour of love and mercy. She was 31 years old. Also buried at Etaples is Sister Gladys Maud Mary Wake of the Canadian Army Medical Corps, and she died of her wounds on the 21st of May, just 2 days after the raid. And back home in Canada, she was also remembered in a newspaper article. And it says that many people in Victoria were shocked to learn yesterday that nursing sister GM Wake was reported to be one of the latest casualty lists as having died during one of the German bombing raids directed against the Allied hospitals at the front. Nursing sister Gladys Wake belonged to a family long resident here, and she herself lived practically her whole life in Victoria, graduating from the Royal Jubilee Hospital in the class of 1912, and only a very short time before the outbreak of war, removing with her mother and sister to the old country. She was a great favourite in the Jubilee Hospital Training School. Nurse Wake proved very able in her profession, and for a considerable time after graduating, was engaged in special nursing duties here. As she was in England when war was declared, she promptly volunteered her services as a nurse and was at least until a year ago last Christmas, as the evidence of a photograph in possession of a friend here proves, was with the Canadian War Contingent Association in Shorncliffe. It is also known that she was nursing for a time at Salankia, but most recently went to one of the hospitals in France. She was about 30 years of age and was of a bright and energetic nature and made many friends outside as well as among the members of her profession. The news that she has fallen victim to German ruthlessness will be received with widespread regret. Now, before she died, she actually wrote a letter back to her folks in Canada. She said, "Darling people, I'm afraid before you get this letter, you'll receive the official announcement that I have been hurt by an air raid. Don't worry, because I'm hopeful for the best. Our padre is very kind, and he will send this to you. I'm shaken a good deal, but don't worry, with fond love." And it was only the next day that the family got news that she died. Her mother wrote about her, "I want to be the first to tell you of our grievous loss. Our little soldier has laid down her life for a fellow man. You'll have seen that the Germans made a raid on the hospitals in France, and our darling with four other sisters, two doctors, and worse still, 57 wounded men were killed. I had a lovely letter from the padre. The raid was on Whit Sunday, 3 weeks to the day since she left England for overseas. A most agonising thought of all, she lingered until Tuesday. But he says she rested calmly and trustfully in God's hands and had wished him to be near her at intervals and was so patient and brave." And like some of the others, we've got a photograph of her funeral procession, which I'll put up on my website, terrystours.co.uk. And in the photo, she's being taken to her grave on a gun carriage by soldiers. And behind her is a procession of nurses walking in twos. And there is words about the funeral itself that was taken from the Toronto Star. And there's a headline at the top. It says, "Funeral of a Canadian nurse, victim of Hun bombs." They quite rightly must have felt quite strongly about it at the time. And when you go to Etaples now, it's so sad when you see not just the graves of the soldiers that died of their wounds there or the soldiers that died in their air raid, but when you see the graves of those young women and all they were trying to do was give help and love and care to not just the British soldiers and the Canadian soldiers, but occasionally the Germans that were brought in, the German prisoners of war. But they died. They died in the same way that so many men did. Now, the footnote to Gladys is that we know from the medical records that she died of leg and fractured femur. And she died, as we said, on the 21st of May, 1918. But she's not going to be forgotten. It's impossible to forget her if you go to British Columbia, because in 1998, one of the mountains in Columbia was named after her, and it's now called Mount Wake. A fitting tribute to that brave young girl. Finally, of course, in November 1918, the war came to an end, but the suffering at Étaples didn't come to an end. The hospital there remained open for some time, and the dying continued, men dying of their wounds, and both men and women, the nurses, dying, succumbing to the terrible flu pandemic that was sweeping the world then. But one of the nurses that survived was called Lorna Neal, and she was working with the motor ambulance convoy, and she was based at Étaples on the Armistice Day. And she said that there was little excitement at all, and even if they wanted to celebrate, they weren't allowed to go out to Étaples, into the town or La Touquet, because they'd be too rowdy and everything was put out of bounds to them, and they had to stay in their billets. And what she says is, and I quote, "In any case, it wasn't very easy to feel jubilant when we seemed to be surrounded by rows and rows of white crosses and acres of hospitals with beds full of wounded men. We just thought, thank God it's over and let's go home." There are some incredible figures that are quoted in Lynn MacDonald's book, The Rosies of No Man's Land, and I'd like to repeat some of them here. The official British figure of wounded men in the Great War is 2,289,860. And that includes 2.2 million that were brought to England in hospital ships from France. And that means that about 29,000 arrived from Malta, the Middle East and Africa. In 1938, 20 years after the war, and on the eve, of course, of World War II, the British government was still paying out 500,000 disability pensions to those men that were wholly or partly disabled as a result of their war service. 8,000 pensions were being paid to men with one or both legs that had been amputated, 3,600 to men with one or both arms amputated, and 90,000 to men who had got withered or useless limbs. 2,000 of those pensions were paid to men that were still completely blind, and 11,000 to men that had been permanently deafened by the explosions of shells, high explosive shells. There was another 15,000 men with head injuries that were so severe that through constant pain or reduced mental capacity, they couldn't work properly. And there were 25,000 men that were suffering from nervous disorders, or what we now call shell shock. I wonder whether the true figure was, of course, much higher than 25,000. And the most horrific figure of all, which I alluded to during the podcast, to me anyway, was that the shell shock for 3,200 men was so bad that 20 years after the end of their service, they were still being confined in mental asylums. And they probably ended up in those mental asylums for the rest of their lives. And in the final paragraph of Lynn's book, she writes, "In February 1980, so this is the time when she wrote her book, pensions were still being paid to 27,000 disabled men who went off to fight for their king and country more than 60 years ago." The figures are appalling, the personal accounts even more so, and it makes us realise that these men owed so much did they owe to those young women that had come from privileged backgrounds, given up their lives to join the voluntary aid detachment and became what is known as VADs. So once again, I'd like to thank you for tuning in to this week's podcast, Tales from the Battlefields, with me, Terry Wenham. Lots more to come in the next few weeks. But for now, I wanted to sign off, as usual, by playing the last post in memory of those nurses that died at Étaples, or perhaps died for other reasons, and are buried in that enormous cemetery near Boulogne on the English Channel coast.